From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, one national analyst shares his insights into yesterday's ruling from the Supreme Court on the Wisconsin redistricting case.
A New York Times reporter chronicles the end of the line for a rural Wisconsin elementary school.
There was, you know, potlucks and end-of-the-year celebrations planned, but everyone knew that this was going to be the last year for this school, and there was definitely a lot of melancholy.
Milwaukee writer Jeff Carter explains the catalyst for his first novel, The P.S. Wars.
I wanted to give a voice and a window into what daily life inside a high school is like to people who probably haven't been there for 30 or 40 years, or people who have never set foot into a city high school.
And Mount Mary University teams with two area community colleges to increase the number of bachelor degree nurses in the region. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The United States Supreme Court's long-awaited ruling on Gill v. Whitford, the Wisconsin redistricting case, came down yesterday. Well, sort of. The court did not rule on the constitutionality question surrounding the claims of illegal partisan gerrymandering. Instead, it ruled that the plaintiffs did not have legal standing to bring the suit and threw the case back to the lower courts, where plaintiffs could adjust their case accordingly.
The high court had been mulling the case over for months. Over that time, we spoke on several occasions with David Daly, senior fellow at Fair Vote, former editor-in-chief of Salon, and author of the book Rat Effed, the True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. And so in the wake of yesterday's decision, we reached him from his office in Massachusetts. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So these deliberations have been going on for quite a long time. Given the length we're talking about here, did the court's Monday decision surprise you in any way?
You're right, yes. I mean, 260 days it had been. It's in the top 10 now of modern cases that have taken the court the longest to resolve. And one would have thought that if they were going to throw this out and back to the district courts on a question of standing, that it might not have taken this long to do so.
Well, and so as you look at how this played out, does this give people on both sides something both to hail and something to disagree with?
Yes, I think it does. There is the opportunity here for the attorneys and the reformers in Wisconsin to re-argue this case in the lower courts and to assert a statewide standing. So I think what you will see is that there will be more plaintiffs from more districts across Wisconsin who are sought out to join the suit, and that you might also have a statewide interest, like the State Democratic Party or other political organizations, that step in and assert their standing. Essentially, what the court unanimously ruled today is that the folks who brought this suit, like Bill Whitford, who live in individual districts, can only challenge a plan that affects their individual district. They can't challenge the entire statewide map. So the new argument is going to have to be that the entire map is what burdens representational rights in the state of Wisconsin, and that it's not simply the ability or inability to have your vote matter towards the election of your individual representative. It's a question of whether all of these districts, when you add up the totality of the gerrymandering across the state, entrenches the Republicans' political power in such a way that the individual Democrats in those districts voting for their own individual representative have their rights violated. It's highly technical, as you
Exactly. Well, and so this seems to get to the heart of this idea that the plaintiffs couldn't prove any direct injury from the way the districts were drawn. But it sounds like the court kind of gave them the roadmap, if they needed one, to establishing what a direct injury might be.
I think that's right. A case in Wisconsin was very much based on a roadmap that Justice Kennedy provided in the last major partisan gerrymandering case back in 2004, the Veith case. And they brought this claim believing that Kennedy had, you know, in a Hansel and Gretel style, you know, scattered pebbles. Well, it turns out some of those pebbles may have been breadcrumbs. So now Elena Kagan has offered a concurrence that will probably become the new Kennedy concurrence for folks who were looking for a silver lining to all of this. And Kagan really clearly lays out that it should not be hard for folks to prove a statewide harm and that there's plenty of evidence here. And indeed, the Wisconsin case is loaded with it. There's all of the draft maps that show how the Republicans who drew these districts have made them more and more aggressive and partisan over the course of 40, 50, 60 different drafts. You can see all of the partisan voting indexes that they used to craft the maps. You can see the email conversations and communications that they were having back and forth. There's a really strong record here for a statewide claim, and nothing the court did today does anything to prevent them from bringing this case again, using all of that evidence again, and hoping that the standing question is settled and resolved. The challenge becomes finding that fifth justice who is going to sign on to it. The Kagan concurrence today had the four liberals' names on it. It did not have Justice Kennedy. So we don't know, moving forward, one, what Kennedy needs to satisfy his own legal sense of what a gerrymandering standard can be, and second, we don't know if Kennedy is even going to be on this court in the next couple of years, or whether he will retire and be replaced by a more conservative justice. So there's certainly optimistic signs here. This is not over yet, but the road is still very, very difficult.
Well, and some of this sounds like it has to be instructive for the lower courts, because at some level, the lower courts to this point had to have been convinced of their standing in the first place.
I think that's right. Certainly, the bipartisan court that, in a very strong ruling, ordered new maps in Wisconsin. It was the first time that a federal court had done that as a unconstitutional partisan gerrymander in the middle of a decade and said, you've got to rip all these up and start over again. Certainly that question of standing was settled in the minds of those federal judges and not a problem. It was not so in the eyes of the nine on the Supreme Court today.
So that puts the plaintiffs in the position of having to convince judges that they convinced in the first place already.
This is a technical and complicated case, and after today, I think we all understand a little bit more why the Supreme Court has never, ever in the history of the country settled on a constitutional standard for determining when a gerrymander goes too far.
Right. Given the long buildup, this feels a little like the air was just slowly let out of the balloon.
There was a real opportunity here for a decision that transformed the way our democracy works, that makes it fairer and more responsive, especially on the verge of the 2018 midterms and the 2020 census. That is only going to be done with better technology and deeper partisan intent. We missed out on a real opportunity today.
Dave Daly, senior fellow at Fair Vote, former editor-in-chief of Salon, and the author of the book Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. You can find more of our coverage of the Supreme Court's decision on redistricting at WUWM.com.
Schools are out for the summer across the country, but students from one elementary school in rural Wisconsin won't be returning to their school in the fall. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Arena, Wisconsin, population 834, does not find itself in the national spotlight very often. For most of the people who live there, they would probably have preferred not to have been in the New York Times last week.
The article was on the closing of the village's Lone Elementary School and how it relates to the broader waning of rural communities like Arena. Julie Bosman is a national correspondent for the New York Times, and we reached her on the line from Chicago. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much.
What turned you on to the story in the first place?
So I cover the Midwest for the New York Times, and I happened to notice that there were a lot of stories in Wisconsin, and I had been personally hearing about the challenges that so many school districts were facing, and school districts primarily in rural communities. And this seemed to be a problem that was being repeated over and over. What do you do when you don't have the population that you used to in a lot of these rural towns? And what happens when the enrollment of these little schools keeps going down and down and down? And when I started making phone calls and talking to superintendents in these areas, they all said the same thing, which is, you know, these communities are really aging. They're not necessarily losing a ton of population, but the population is getting a lot older, and there aren't as many farms out here anymore. There aren't as many farm families anymore, and people aren't having as many children. So when all of those things add up, you get elementary schools that have 40 kids in them, and that becomes a real problem for budgets and a real problem for the future of these communities.
Well, I get the sense that a lot of these communities, these are places that years ago may have had their own high school, but there's been consolidation at the high school level for a long time.
Absolutely. And this consolidation has really happened in waves for decades and decades. I mean, when you look at the entire country, the total number of schools in America has gone way down, and it's been going down for probably 130 years. But the areas that have been hit the hardest are rural areas. And there was a big wave of consolidation in the 1950s and 1960s when a lot of little one-room schoolhouses were closed down. And those were the schoolhouses that were really out in the middle of the country. And then you had the smaller towns, like the one that I focused on, Arena, which is outside of Spring Green, that were left with these with their own schools. And in many cases, this is also when the high school is closed. So when I went to the Spring Green area and talked to people in the village of Lone Rock and the village of Arena, there were people who were still really, really angry over the fact that the high school in Arena had closed in, you know, around 1960. So people have very long memories about school closures.
Well, and at some level, this is about more than just a school.
It is. And I think that it goes way beyond the school itself, because some of the people who are most upset over these closures don't have children in the school, might not even have grandchildren in the school, but have lived in the community for a really long time and understand how important a school can be to a community. They can really be the bedrock of the area, not just a school, but, you know, a visible presence, a place where the community can gather, sort of an informal town hall of sorts. And I think that when the schools go away, people know that it's going to mean a lot more than there's not going to be an elementary school here. It's going to stand empty. And that's upsetting on its own. What's going to go into this school that was built in the 1950s that hasn't been modernized, that doesn't really have a ton of other good uses? And I think people know that it's going to affect everybody's property values and the future of the town.
How long had the situation in Arena been building towards this particular denouement?
I would say probably more than a decade. When I spoke to the superintendent there, he said that you know, the population in the area for the school district, which includes Arena, Spring Green, Lone Rock, and another small village called Plain, he said that it had been at least 15 years since the population had been going down. And there was really not that much that they could do about that. The farming jobs, of course, had disappeared or at least decreased in large numbers, and there weren't as many manufacturing jobs either. So they looked at the numbers, and they commissioned a study from UW, and it looked like the problem was only going to get worse in the future.
They tried some things to try to head this off, right?
They did, and you know, the school officials there took no pleasure in closing the Arena School and the Lone Rock School, which closed at the end of the last school year, a year ago. They did a referendum in 2016 asking voters for more money. They said, look, if we're going to keep these schools open, we have to have more money. And I think they asked for $9.3 million, which would be spent over the next several years. And the voters said no. And, of course, this was incredibly upsetting to people in these towns where they lost their schools. But a lot of people just had a very, you know, clear-eyed look at what was going on and said, there's no future for these schools, and we're just throwing money at them, and we need to face the facts.
You mentioned the resentment that's still out there from closing the high school in 1960. I would imagine that there's plenty of resentment over this vote just, you know, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I think that there were a lot of families that, you know, were divided over this, a lot of friendships. I spoke with people who said, you know, I just couldn't even bring it up anymore because it was so upsetting to hear the things that people were saying, you know, and it kind of came down to like village versus village. You know, you have this school district that covers about 300 square miles. And of course, this is, you know, one of the most beautiful places in Wisconsin. Taliesin is there, you know, the bluffs, and it's incredibly picturesque. And you can see why people would want to live there. But it became this really angry fight from village to village where Spring Green people tended to vote against the referendum, saying, no, we don't want to give any more money. And the smaller villages said, no, we actually do, and we support this. So it became a matter of geography within the district that determined how people felt about this particular issue.
Right. It sounds a little like, you know, maybe a microcosm of the way Wisconsin works as a whole, you know, sort of Milwaukee being the big city and the rural-urban divide, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at population patterns in Wisconsin and in plenty of other states, you know, the numbers are right there. Like the population shifts over the last couple of decades, people are moving out of rural areas and into cities and into suburban areas. And that was one of the things that made this story so stark, that when you look at the people of Arena, you know, they're not very far from Madison. A lot of people who, you know, live in the Spring Green area work in Madison and just have kind of a long commute to work, but it's not that far away. But the school districts in, say, Middleton, Wisconsin, outside of Madison, like, they're beautiful. The schools are huge. They have much more modern facilities. The kids have more programming. It's like night and day.
How much time did you spend in Arena for this story?
I worked on the story over a period of months, a lot of phone reporting. I visited there in person a few months ago and spent some time at the school and spent some time talking to families there. And it was just one of those stories that really interested me personally, and I was happy that I had a good amount of time to plug away on it.
Yeah, I mean, can you paint a picture of what the waning days of the elementary schools last year felt like? And I mean, you were there not right at the end of the school year, but close, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of mournful. I think that, you know, the teachers and the parents in Arena did everything they could to try to make it smooth for the kids. And if anyone tended to be okay with it, it was probably the kids who went there. I mean, I think kids tend to kind of roll with the situation, and they were more okay with going to the Spring Green school next fall than their parents were. But in many ways, when you went to the Arena school, it looked like a school that was winding down for the end of the school year, like all schools do. You know, the teachers had started kind of taking their classrooms down, taking the posters down. Things were getting packed up. There was, you know, potlucks and end-of-the-year celebrations planned. But everyone knew that this was going to be the last year for this school. And there was definitely a lot of melancholy as people, you know, talked about that and thought about what the bigger implications were for their community.
I gather you grew up in Wisconsin. I don't know how large a school district you called home when you were young, but I wonder if you know, you had any kinds of elementary school flashbacks while you were doing this.
So I grew up in Kenosha, and I went to the a big public high school in Kenosha, Mary D. Bradford on the north side of Kenosha. But I had a very different experience from my elementary school, which was, you know, a small parochial school where I think if we had 15 kids in a classroom, that was considered large. And actually, every time that I go home to visit family, I often my route takes me past that old school, which has now been consolidated with a different school. So you can see this. It's not just a public school problem. It's something that is happening in, for private schools, too. And I think it takes a lot of adjustment to people, and it sends a message about, you know, how their communities are changing. And I think it's a very tough thing for a lot of people.
Well, Julie Bossman, it's a really affecting story. Job well done, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Julie Bossman is a native of the Kenosha area. She's a national correspondent for the New York Times and is based in Chicago. You can find a link to her feature on the closing of the elementary school in Orena, Wisconsin at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and when we return, the fictional account of a Milwaukee urban school on the verge of a hostile takeover. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Jeff Carter has been teaching high school English in Milwaukee public schools for nearly 30 years. Most of his students are considered at risk. It is safe to say he has strong opinions about the importance of public schools and the dynamics that exist here, including public, private, charter, and voucher schools.
Carter has written a fair amount on the subject on his blog, but his latest writing takes the form of a novel. It's called The P.S. Wars. The novel envisions a hostile takeover of a fictional Milwaukee high school by a private, for-profit charter. Carter joined me in the studio recently and explain why he chose to fictionalize this story.
I have felt that basically the people I work with, the teachers who work so hard and you know, basically give everything to their kids, weren't getting a good voice. They weren't being heard. So what I wanted to do was actually create a venue and create a kind of a discourse where they would actually, we could actually see what they're doing and actually look at their day-to-day struggles with that. I originally had started a memoir and I got done with that, and it just didn't really quite seem to be carrying the message I wanted to do, that the teachers had their voice. And that basically that this was going to address kind of the needs for public schools and why public schools are so important. So I decided to try the kind of the fiction, which turned out to be the P.S. Wars. And it may seem kind of counterintuitive to think that a novel can, like, you know, address the truth more directly than a nonfiction piece. But as Mark Twain said, the only difference between reality and fiction is that fiction needs to be credible. And as we know from the discourse going on today, that's very much true. So it just turned out to be the better choice for me.
Well, and you choose some really interesting characters to tell that story. And Dave, your lead character, is not exactly a Boy Scout.
No, not at all. He's actually there's quite a bit of Dave Bell in me, but he's a he's a human being. He's got his foibles, like the rest of us. But what I really wanted to create in him was, is for all his other faults, he's like a very, very good teacher, very committed to his students, and very very much a good educator, like and has a lot of the qualities I wanted to bring out in terms of what a good educator should be. Committed to his students, ready to give all for the students, put his safety on the line for the students, as he does when he breaks up the fight in one of the chapters. And that's where I kind of wanted to bring it out with him.
Well, you set the P.S. Wars in a fictional Milwaukee school somewhere in the center city. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people who've either gone to school here, have taught here, or know anything about education here could probably point to a couple of schools and say, oh, it's this one, and oh, no, it's this one. Mm-hmm. Who did you hope to reach with this book? I mean, teachers are going to see themselves in this. Mm-hmm. Maybe even people who went through the public schools at some point. Mm-hmm. But are not teachers now, would see themselves in this. Are you trying to reach people outside of the bubble of education?
Yes, I am. I was. I really, like I said, I wanted to give a voice and kind of a window into like what daily life inside a high school is like to people who probably haven't been there for 30 or 40 years, or people who have never set foot into a city high school, which is very much different than maybe some suburban experiences or some other experiences too. And it is a tough day-to-day struggle that a lot of the teachers, and especially a lot of the students, are going through too. I mean, they come in from environments of sometimes just incredible poverty and trauma. And some cases, homelessness. I mean, there's all sorts of adversity they bring with them into the school building. And so I wanted to kind of show what their environments, what their lives are like, and what it's really like trying to teach them to a public high school these days.
Well, and you also bring in the private charter, which in this case is pretty much a sort of an enemy. Mm-hmm. Initially, I'm not going to give away what happens at the end, but, you know, they're seen as people who are a company who is interested in profit over education, over the needs of the students, and they see a school takeover as a way to make money. Is that something that you witnessed happening in your time at FPS?
In some cases, yes. I mean, the charters, I mean, it's a whole smorgasbord of like different kind of quality of them. The public charters who actually have to adhere to the same rules of the school board as public schools do very, very well. Some private charters are good, but my main gripe with them is the lack of transparency. Basically, a public school or a public charter has to answer to the taxpayers. They are adhering to the rules and regulations that are put forth by the school board, who are, of course, elected by us. Private charters are private corporations who are I don't want to say make up their own rules, but basically,
They're beholden to their stockholders.
There you go. And in terms of curriculum, they can decide what curriculum to teach their students. In terms of licensing, they can decide what kind of licenses their teachers need. In some cases, they'll take people without any teaching experience whatsoever. And that's kind of the safeguard I really think we need to keep for public schools, transparency and the fact that basically the schools are responsible to us, the taxpayers.
I want to go back to what you were saying about telling the teachers' stories. Do you feel that teachers, particularly here in Milwaukee, aren't having their stories told, that people don't know what they do?
I do. I think that many teachers are, first of all, I think teachers are, for some reason, this country are demonized and vilified, I think, a lot more than a lot of other professions. Teachers tend to be the scapegoat for a lot of the problems going on in the education system. I know during the Act 10 legislation, too, they were blamed for, basically sucking all the money up out of the state budget. But in truth, teachers I've seen and teachers I've worked with, for the most part, are dedicated. They're all hours of the day for their students. They're bringing in their own supplies that they pay for out of their own pocket. They're committed to their kids. They really love their kids, and they'll do anything for them. So I do think that story is not being told, and which is one of my compelling reasons for actually writing this, which is actually to let people know that there is a lot of good going on in public schools, Milwaukee public schools, and public schools nationwide.
When you bring in EduNet, there are obviously characters who are very corporate and very focused. You also don't demonize them completely. There are a couple of people within that structure who are trying to do the right thing as they see it, too. Mm-hmm. And has that been your experience when you were dealing with private charters?
Well, I think people are just, complex beings, and In this case, I think, yeah, the people who are in the charters and who are working for the charters are, you know, by their own lights trying to do the right thing for the most part. But the character I really liked in this one, Sandra Feely, who is one of the people who works for EduNet, turns out has a brother who was raised in public schools or who was taught through public schools and who has Down syndrome. And she starts to realize that that basically if it had not been for public schools, he would not have like actually been able to get the education he's gotten. Because in many cases, charter schools, private charters, in this case, EduNet 2 specifically, rather underserves a lot of the students with special ed needs.
They're not required to, right?
No. If they're running their own requirements, many of them do not. Many of them do, but they're underserved. It's not as many as a big population that are served by public schools because it is a big budget drain.
Well, and public schools, the whole idea is that it's the public.
Right.
Whoever the public is made up of, you know, you have a right to an education. That's the kind of the basic premise.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you think we have such a contentious attitude towards public schools?
Well, I think for the urban schools, I think, and this goes into the entire, I think, the Wisconsin political mindset that I think Milwaukee in general is kind of vilified by politicians statewide. And we're often, I think, depicted as a money pit, you know, where all the money goes, and that public schools here are just kind of like this black hole where, you know, a lot of our funding goes to. I'm not sure why we are so vilified, but I know the Act 10 had a lot to do with it, too, when that legislation was brought in 2011, and they were threatening to take away teachers' rights. The whole rhetoric that came along with that package was, basically aimed at teachers saying, well, you know, they're sucking all the money off, you know, off our budget. They're overpriced. They're, you know, they don't work as hard. They only work 9 months a year. And there was all that attached to it, I think, too. So, and generally, I think teachers are, as I said before, typically have been scapegoats for a lot that's wrong with the educational system. People tend to look at surface problems, and if they don't really dig deep, and to me at least, I think one of the root causes to our problems in our urban education system is poverty. And until that is addressed and addressed seriously, I don't think a lot's going to happen. This could be different.
Now that the book is out, what has been the reaction that you've gotten from people who have read it? I know you've done some readings around town, mm-hmm. and you'll probably continue to do so. How are people responding to it?
Teachers I work with and teachers I've known, actually, I've had a couple come up and thank me and say, thanks for, giving us a voice. Generally, people have liked it. I've had pretty positive feedback so far.
Any pushback?
Not really not at this point, though, too. But I do think I do land on one side of the public-private issue, but I don't think I'm very – I don't think it's, like, really strident, you know, in terms of that. I try to be fair, and I think people recognize that, too. And also the fact that I think that it's character-driven is very much of a struggles the characters are going through in terms of, like, the public-private argument and the sensibilities and, like, you know, what they're realizing, what they're doing, and what they're doing to the community, the school. I think people get wrapped up in the characters and the issue sometimes becomes secondary.
Yeah, I felt that when I was reading the book, I found that I was kind of caught up in what was going to happen to these people. Mm. And I found myself, you know, turning the page, and again, not giving anything away. There were a couple of twists that you pulled towards the end that I thought, no!
Yeah,
and I'm not going to give away what that reaction was about, but there were some things where I thought, wow. And I also have to say that I think you ended, again, without giving anything away, I think you ended the book on a more positive than negative note. Is that? Do you think that's fair?
I think that's true. And my publisher's sister actually wrote a little note to me, and she said at the end that it was like, she says, yeah, I can kind of see more of a kind of a, not a compromise, but a new kind of like a new order coming up, as it were. So, yeah, I won't give anything else away either. So.
Right. Yeah. But there's this sense that, well, things will go on. It's just, it's again like life, not all bad, not all good. Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be some adjustments. Do you feel that you have any more of any of these character stories to tell in another book?
I've toyed with the idea of a sequel. I'm working on something else right now, but I think I will come back to this as a the continuation of Custer High School. What's going on with that?
So. Yeah, there's a couple of characters. For example, Ethel Benjamin, who's been teaching for 40 years mm-hmm. and is someone that all the other teachers look up to, mm-hmm. and who has this like backbone of steel and is just such an interesting person.
Yeah, she's. I loved writing her. Actually, she kind of grew into a character I really liked, and. The fact that, you know, she swears like a sailor when she's not around kids, and that she's tough as a bar of iron. And
has a huge heart.
And, yeah, and is a really, really nice person. Yeah, it's like, she was a lot of fun.
For you, when you sit down to write, particularly a fiction, do the characters come first, or are you kind of thinking about a scenario and the characters come into it?
It's kind of simultaneous at the beginning, because I think you'll have characters, and then I always try to have a destination in mind for the end of the novel. And in this one, and actually the piece I'm working on right now too, I kind of like to have a kind of a converging narrative, almost two narratives. Like in this case, we had the EduNet person, Mitchell Page, and Dave Bell, and their narratives kind of converged. And there were others along the way there too. But this conflict kind of, you know, reaches a climax. That's kind of like what I was aiming at then too. But the characters... are paramount, I think, pretty much, too.
Do they talk to you while you're in the process of writing? Do you hear them in your head?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the only voices I hear in my head, though.
Well, it's okay. It's all right. Every writer I've ever talked to has always said something like, yeah, you know, they're telling me mm-hmm. things. And characters, I think, have their own minds. Once they mm-hmm. burst forth from your imagination, they sort of have their own ideas of what they're going to do.
Well, it's funny because, yeah, once you kind of give them like kind of these, you know, their characteristics or traits, and they kind of have to adhere to those traits to be, you know, to be logical. Like with Ethel, for instance, I mean, she has to behave a certain way after a point when you've given her so many, you know, characteristics, though, too. But they will surprise you, though, every now and then.
Every now and then, yeah. Which is, of course, keeps it interesting for you as well. Do yeah. you miss teaching?
Well, actually, I'm still working part-time doing a little bit of I was called in, and I always joke I'm like Michael Corleone in The Godfather. I keep trying to get out. They keep pulling me back in.
Milwaukee writer Jeff Carter's new novel is called The P.S. Wars. You can read more about it at WUWM.com.
We will take one last break, and then what one area college is doing to help alleviate the region's nursing shortage. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Welcome back to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We first reported on the looming nursing shortage in the Milwaukee area on this show in 2009.
9 years later, the situation has not improved. In fact, it may be more critical. And more institutions are looking for ways to train more nurses. Case in point is Mount Mary University, which recently announced a partnership with Waukesha County Technical College to graduate more bachelor's degree nurses.
That comes on the heels of a similar partnership with Milwaukee Area Technical College. Cheryl Bailey is Dean of the School of Natural and Health Sciences at Mount Mary and joined us in the studio last month. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you give us a sense for the current paradigm? How did we get to the point that we're in when it comes to nursing, both locally, regionally, and maybe even on a national scale?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a couple of things. One of them is the growth of the population needing health care. And so, therefore, we need more healthcare professionals. And then also the limitations of the schools to be able to graduate the number of nurses for which there are position openings. And part of that reason is because integral and very important to that education is clinical experience. And so the schools work with hospitals to provide clinical experiences as integrated part of the nurse's education. And that has a limitation because of everybody's workforce and everybody's hours in the day that they're able to oversee these students. And so because of that, there's a limitation on how many students can graduate from these nursing programs.
Well, and nurses practice in a variety of settings, not just hospitals, but hospitals are still the place where most of them get their clinical practical mm-hmm. experience.
And I think that brings up another important point is that nurses are broadening their medical care and interaction with patients in all types of realms. And so that has then increased even more the demand for nurses.
Well, and it sounds to me like at the same time, it might build on itself because with a nursing shortage, there are fewer people who go into nursing who are in a position to also teach nursing.
Yes, that is true. There is a shortage in teachers of nursing. And so another shortage comes in that the healthcare organizations are interested in nurses with their experience to move into leadership positions, which is a wonderful idea, and that's something that we're focusing on in our program is leadership development. And so that very positive effect also has an effect of the nurses then leaving the direct health patient care into these leadership positions.
Can you give us a sense for how many nurses are needed in the area?
The Wisconsin Center for Nursing is predicting a need of 20,000 nurses by 2020.
20,000 new nurses by
Correct.
2020.
Yes. Bachelor's prepared nurses by 2020.
And this is a year and a half from now.
Yeah. Actually, I hadn't realized it is.
Well, and given let me take a step back. And these are nurses at a variety of levels or RNs, bachelor's degree nurses versus associate degree nurses or nurses across the board?
This would be bachelor's prepared nurses. And part of that is because of the magnet status of hospitals can be reached in part with 80% of their nurses having a bachelor's degree. And so that's part of this push and need for these 20,000 nurses by 2020.
You're smiling as you say 20,000 nurses by 2020 because it seems like a steep hill to climb.
Yes, a worthy challenge.
Well, so talk about what the various partnerships. There's a new partnership that Mount Mary's announced with WCTC, mm-hmm. Waukesha County Technical College, and an existing partnership with Milwaukee Area Technical College. How do they go after this problem?
Mm-hmm. What we're doing is developing a pathway for students to be able to attain a bachelor's degree in nursing, combining the relative expertise of Mount Mary University and WCTC, for example. And in this case, the students would begin at Mount Mary. Their trajectory is always towards the bachelor degree in nursing. They will satisfy the pre-requirements for the WCTC nursing program, as they also take courses towards the bachelor's. Those are always in coinciding. They'll be able to complete the associate's degree at nursing at WCTC, obtain their RN, and then with that RN be able to, at Mount Mary, complete their Bachelor of Science of Nursing online as they work as an RN, if that's how they choose to do that.
So it's possible that they could get their associate's degree in nursing, obtain their RN, and be practicing nursing even as they work towards getting a bachelor's level nursing degree.
Yes, as they complete that bachelor's degree level nursing degree. Their Mount Mary, the very nice thing about this partnership is that they're Mount Mary students all 4 years. They can take advantage of resources at both campuses, clubs, tutoring, things like that. However, all their financial aid and all of that part of their systems runs through one institution, and that helps them streamline that process and also keep all of that so that they're not running out of eligible financial aid by having it go through one institution. The other thing is that they can live on campus in our residence halls at Mount Mary all 4 years, even while they're taking classes. And we've had a student, for example, whose family has, for a job, moved out of state. She wants to continue here, even when she's taking courses at MATC in this case, and she's delighted that she's able to stay in our residence halls all 4 years of her bachelor's degree.
So does the partnership with MATC work essentially in a similar way to the one with WCTC?
Yes. Everybody has been very collegial. So all of this has worked the same. Curriculum, all of these different components has worked the same. Very few differences. And that's great because then it allows the students to have a clear pathway with Mount Mary and either WCTC or MATC.
And do you have a sense for why one would, is it essentially appealing to people from different geographic parts of the Milwaukee area?
That seems to be the primary differentiator.
What kind of capacity does a program like this have with a need for 20,000 nurses by 2020? Presumably, there are not going to be 20,000 students doing this, but what sort of capacity are we talking about?
So starting out, the numbers are going to sound small. However, this is the first step. With MATC, we have 32 guaranteed seats for our students to progress into their program as long as they meet certain grades and background checks and an entrance exam scores as they progress from Mount Mary into their program. And so that's one of the real benefits. They're not petitioning to MATC. They're meeting all those requirements and then joining MATC and starting in that program. With WCTC, it's 16 seats, 8 in the fall and 8 in the spring. So again, those numbers sound small, but that's that many more, and that would be for every year. And then we hope to expand beyond that.
Well, I guess, what are the challenges in recruiting people to be to take up nursing as a profession? And, you know, what are the advantages when you reach out to people who are, deciding what kind of coursework they're taking in school?
There's a lot of enthusiasm for being a nurse because people have experienced that often in their lives. We have both types of students. We have a lot of students coming straight from high school. They have ideas about wanting to be a nurse. They're enthusiastic about starting in the program. And then we have some people that are sometimes this could be a second career, or it can be that they started college and then for whatever life happenings prevented them from continuing on. And so we have an interest in helping all of these students with the coursework and the strong student support that we have at Mount Mary University. We have an 81% retention rate, and the reason we have that is because of the culture of student support. And so we're happy with all the students. Some are afraid to go to college in the first place. Some are afraid to go back to college. Some are enthusiastic and ready to get into class. And so we are interested in individually helping every single one of those students.
Is it at all challenging to kind of blend the two campus climates, or really three campus climates?
What we do for that is that we have supports for all different types of students coming in. And so in that case, we do have overlapping and then specialized support. But what we find happens in the classroom is that you have people with life experience, you have people coming in, even the students coming from high school often have some experience that they bring to the table. And that is enriching for all students. And so that we consider to be a benefit when we have as high of a diversity as we can. That helps both cognitive and non-cognitive development of everybody in the classroom.
Still a big challenge ahead.
Yes, it is. And another thing that we're very proud about at Mount Mary in this same regard is that you may not realize we're over 50% women of color. And so we have definitely made very specific supports and environment to be welcoming and to be inclusive. And so we have a high Pell eligible and a high first generation students. And so that only enriches the experience of everybody on campus.
And I would imagine for nursing graduates, they're pretty employable at this point.
Yes, very employable. And so that's where in this program, even before they finish their bachelor's, they would be able to be employed and then continue online to finish that degree. When they're coming to Mount Mary, they can be either part-time or full-time. And then when they're at MATC or WCTC, we are asking for them to be full-time because it helps them to go through those nursing courses as a cohort in the way that they're learning and working together in teams. And so there's the flexibility, and then there's the push in the middle to get that RN so that they can work and then continue finishing the BSN online.
Well, and so how long does it take to go from having that RN to getting the BSN if the if they're taking coursework online?
So if they went full time, it would take, and they went in the summers, it could take as little as 3 semesters. But what we find is the students are feeling comfortable taking 2 courses a semester. So in that case, it's going to take longer. And then sometimes they get revved up and want to take a lot of courses in a semester. So that part-time, full-time will affect how long that takes. Also, that affects how long it takes for them to be ready to start those nursing courses at MATC or WCTC. But we understand that people have all kinds of life happenings, and so we work with that well.
And presumably, once they've gotten to the point where they have the RN, they may well be working a significant amount of the time as well.
Correct. Right. And so that's the students we find are interested in having a part-time experience until they want to just get it done. And then they'll sometimes go full-time.
Are you exploring other potential partnerships or other creative ways of approaching the nursing shortage down the road?
Mm-hmm. So we are interested in looking at some of the other partnerships that would be other community colleges to broaden this, to allow this to expand to more geographic spaces. Yes.
Well, thank you so much. Best of luck in your work, and I hope we can talk again down the road.
All right. Thank you very much.
Dr. Cheryl Bailey is the Dean of the School of Natural and Health Sciences at Mount Mary University. You'll find a link to more about the school's nursing school partnerships with MATC and WCTC from a link at wuwm.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.